I'm joined now by Andrew Schemmann. He is the writer and director of the short film Breakfast of Champions, available now on zeal.co. Fantastic film. I really enjoyed it. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Awesome. So I actually just finished watching it for the second time, and one of those cool things where you watch it and you see something different every time. Mm-hmm. But I say first things first, what was the inspiration for the short film?
Sure. Well, it had a very clear origin and genesis. I had watched a video in the fall of 2022. It was an advertising campaign for a clothing brand that was, I would say, beautifying the concept of assisted suicide. It was a Canadian clothing company called Simons. And, you know, as a director, I'm familiar with the way that you enhance a subject to make it appealing and all these kind of storytelling effects. And it was a really, really beautifully shot 3-minute long campaign called All Is Beauty. And it was about a woman describing her choice to end her life at 37 with a disease that she had in Canada. And I was really just shocked and horrified. I mean, first of all, just to be promoting assisted suicide and euthanasia. But what was really scary to me was the beautification of it. And I thought, if people can conceive of this and if they can get people together to make it, this is really a step towards normalizing it culturally.
So okay, I almost need to stop you here.
Yeah.
This was a commercial to sell clothing that was promoting assisted suicide. How was that even done mechanically? Like, I'm having a hard time wrapping my... Someone taking their own life at 37, but we want to sell you clothes. How'd they do it?
Yeah, I don't know the mechanics of what really inspired the person to make this. I think it was more about attaching to a cultural vision or an ideology, and they just thought, this is beautiful. You know, we would like to attach our brand to this.
Wow.
So, you know, the scene opens saying dying in a hospital is not what's natural. It's not what's soft. So whether that's supposed to talk about the softness of clothing compared to like the softness of choosing to end your own life, I thought it was really ridiculous.
Yeah.
And so eventually I kind of wanted to come up with a response, and it was to me, in a way, it was darkly over the top and kind of a comedic concept. I have a background. I did comedy shows back in college. I founded my own group in grad school. And I just thought that this was really bait for some kind of mockery. But, you know, as the idea developed, it became what the short film is.
Yeah. And I love the bar that you chose. I've listened to some other interviews that you've done, and it's a real place. It's actually in Pennsylvania. And I actually have a similar spot that I kind of affectionately refer people to, because you can still smoke inside. It does open in the morning, and everyone in there knows each other. Like I joke that someone in there, I call her the godfather, because it's this 60-year-old woman. She works a blue collar job. And before someone enters the bar, everyone gives her a hug and a kiss. And I'm like, I love it because I think that's really beautiful. And it's that third space for people that maybe feel kind of cast out by society, either too old or too ugly or whatever. And they can all come together there and they can share in their misery, have some fun, you know, be lighthearted. And then you leave and you feel kind of filled up. And I felt like the choice for that bar, it just reminded me so much of this place that I love. So can you tell me how you actually found the bar for your set location?
Yeah. So this is just that kind of place like you described. It's called Johnny and Hans in Reading, Pennsylvania. And it was important to me to not shoot this in New York, because you can kind of fake a dive bar. First of all, it's very complicated to try to get time in a busy New York establishment. So, and I thought this really has to speak to some geographical location that's a little more forgotten culturally. It just so happened that kind of in a totally unrelated business conversation, somebody I was talking to was saying that he has a cousin who does film out in Reading, PA. And I'm like, I'm working on something right now. You know, maybe your cousin would talk to me. He might know locations. That would be a perfect place to shoot. And so it just worked out. He had a place like that. That's that he goes to, and that he loves the community there. And I said, yeah, send me some pictures. I really had a specific idea of visually what I wanted with the light blasting through the window in the middle of the afternoon. And this place, Johnny and Hans, had that, and the entire decor is perfect. It's very local. There's all this Philly stuff on the walls. And we got our two great locals to basically perform the reality of that space, Doc and Ed, two regulars at the bar. And awesome. I think they brought it to life more than anything else. I could never find an actor like that from New York or LA. Nobody could be as authentic as those two guys.
Totally. And I love one thing that I noticed, and get more into the premise here, the entire conversation between Don Joy and I believe Elvis was the name of the bartender happens kind of with those two in the background, pretty much silent the entire time. And it was almost like listening to a conversation about their fate without their input at all, in their home space that they love. So take me into this Don Joy comes in, and first off, great casting, and I want to get into that a little bit more because it reminded me of Black Mirror, which is a series that I kind of love for the wrong reasons. Like, it makes me feel really uneasy, and I think that's cool. But so she comes in and she's selling Best Life. So how did you come up with that phrase, and how did you think out the interplay between her and the bartender?
Well, so I conceived of a larger universe where there's a corporate entity who's marketing euthanasia, which is a thing that, you know, we may eventually see probably in a more hidden form. But if there's economic incentives to euthanize people, you know, you will have people who go to work every day thinking, how can we reach our customers? And so I kind of used as a model the way pharmaceutical companies would go to doctors to talk about new treatments for their patients, which can be beneficial, or it could be a little bit underhanded and nefarious. So I thought, well, I think in this circumstance, they'd be going to, you know, dive bars and just collecting washed up people who they don't think, who they think could be targeted. These are their targets. And so it's exactly that. She's really dealing with the bartender as it shows that he has some kind of responsibility for that space that he manages that maybe he hadn't thought about before. And in a way, I'm just trying to say the way that we kind of culturally have to look out for one another as you know, new developments in widespread euthanasia are becoming more culturally normalized. You know, everybody just kind of thinks about what would I do? But I think the bigger question, what I'm trying to point towards here, is that what do you want other people to do for you? And what are you doing for other people? You know, because the conversation is really going to come to something like that. It's much more complicated than people saying, I don't want to suffer at the end of my life. I think the real story we're going to see with euthanasia is a new set of norms that we're going to have to navigate.
Yeah, and I almost see, like, we can just set the debate aside. I believe it's the second leading cause of death in Canada right now. I mean, it's just a shocking amount of people.
I think, yeah, it's second or third.
Need a fact check, but even just to imagine that for a second, I mean, it's hard to imagine the pure numbers, raw numbers. And it's just getting pushed further and further and further into now people that can claim mental health distress. Yeah. So it's not even, like, terminal. So, of course, it may start with good reasoning and then, of course, becomes kind of a slippery slope.
Yeah, and it basically, and everybody wants to deny the slippery slope, but it's absolutely there. Netherlands has had 100,000 assisted suicides since 2002. Canada's now broken that only since 2016, and it's increasing really quickly. And it typically goes from thinking it's only for terminal illnesses, people who can't choose to end their life on their own, then it just becomes chronic illnesses, then any kind of disability, than just mental illness, and eventually, which is already happening in Canada, making it allowable for minors.
Wow. I mean, okay, so this film's more important than ever, and one thing that stuck out to me is it's an inherently Christian message, the stewardship message of the bartender. You know, what are you doing for the least among us? Some type of responsibility for your fellow man. But what's interesting to me is when Don Joy comes in, she's using euphemisms in what she might cynically argue, or maybe she even believes it, is actually for the benefit of these old men in the bar. And it felt to me like Elvis was, as you said, caught off guard because he may have these inherent positions, but had never been confronted with someone that was willing to so casually project on him, you know, accusing him of what she's doing. And I feel like we've seen that in many different ways in society, but this one feeling like the new frontier, this is actually out of compassion. This is the right thing to do. This is somehow the just thing to do. And I really felt like this was great for me to start formulating in my own mind. What are my strong moral convictions and how can I articulate them in a way to confront when this comes? And do you have, I guess, an answer for what you would like people to take away from this film? Because we've talked about this is a wave that's coming. It's already here. How do you see approaching that conversation when the Dawn Joys come to you in your life via social media or in real life even?
Yeah, I think it's a lot for any one person to defend themselves against. I see my role as a dramatic artist, a storyteller, filmmaker, to kind of do the work of seeing the bigger picture and giving people the tools to understand that. People are not prepared. And I've had a lot of, when I was making the film and I showed some rough drafts to people and I had conversations with people, even as I was writing it, and, you know, the average person would just say, you know, people should have a right to dignity and they should be free from suffering. But I think the film's trying to show that, like, there's a lot more going on that we have to understand. And I think that's the power of movies is to, you know, nobody's going to, like, tune in. There's plenty of essays and things out there where you can learn about the other sides of the argument. That's not really how culture absorbs things. So I think that making films is a way to present these topics in a way that anybody can attach to, see what the characters are going through, and in a way kind of think it through for themselves. And then my job is to kind of find the nuances and the unexpected things that you might be faced with that you hadn't thought with. And that's how you start to open minds. Like, oh, I didn't really think about that. Or when you tell people 5% of all deaths in Canada are assisted suicide, 7% in Quebec, and that it's being opened up for mental illness and for minors and for non-terminal diseases. People didn't know that. But you have to find a way to kind of make it relatable and a little bit entertaining.
Yeah, for sure. Did you always have the desire and sensibilities to try to do exactly as you described? Because there's, let's just say there's easier ways to get attention, right? Like you can do all kinds of different short films or longer films. You could have done Marvel movies, whatever, you know, but was this something that was always kind of on your heart, or do you see a path in your past working in filmmaking that led you to what you're making now?
I'm not really sure, except to say that a lot of, you know, over the last 10 years, I've been unhappy in the direction that the culture of the film industry has gone, whether it's kind of making more and more bland content that just doesn't really, I think at the same time, we have like more and more bland content and more ideological content, but that's always going in one direction. There should be a countercurrent. There should be other points of view. And I think that there's a big gap in the market for showing other sides of the story and these kind of things. Like, I don't really necessarily want this to be like, you know, it's not a political movie, or it's not a thing that I want to do to be political. It's more like these are things that we're all going to be dealing with. And it's very important. It's just very important. I think it's important for individuals and for society. So it was worth exploring. But I mean, personally, I'm open to all kinds of filmmaking, just, you know, pure fun or for pure comedy, but also,
yeah,
something that speaks to, I think it's important to speak to what we're going through in society. It's a place where people have that cultural discussion left at a subconscious level. And if people are making subconscious arguments on one side, then people don't realize they're being swayed. So you have to pay very close attention and find a way to create a space for the other side.
Yeah. I have two questions for you. One, why? Why do you think that in the last 10 years, things have gotten more bland and more ideological? Sorry, I got to spit that one out. And then the second question being, you mentioned that there's subconscious arguments, but in one direction. Do you have an example of a modern film or something that's in vogue right now that you would argue does a great job of subconsciously pushing people in a direction without people knowing about it?
I'll have to think about that. I'm not sure. But as for why it's gotten more bland and more ideological, I think that goes to however many years you want to call it, that film production has gone like higher and higher towards the studios and the VC, and their incentives are it's a conformity issue, I would say, in both cases, that you don't want to be offending your very large audience, so you don't want to make risky choices. And we see that all the time. You know, if you want to pitch a film project, you just have to go through layers of decision makers, and eventually it's just somebody who's looking at a balance sheet, and you know, everybody wants their undertaking to hopefully make money, but producing cultural things isn't really like that. So I think that it's about not taking risk at offending people's sensibilities, and not taking risk in offending kind of a conformist ideology. And for that, you know, everything that culturally we've seen in the last 10, 15 years, there's a conformity to a certain way of thinking that it's not just writers and directors doing that. There's just so many other people really involved that you have to kind of go along to get along within the industry. And so everybody, every gatekeeper from casting directors to film festivals, if you don't go with the program, you're probably not going to get a job. And then that's over the time that there's more and more people who need to conform to the normal point of view. That's all that's left, and anybody else is left out.
Yeah. And so with that in mind, you went about this. I read your credits at the end, and it seemed like a pretty tight operation. So How did you go about doing this film to make a point to go outside of that system? What went into the actual production of Breakfast of Champions?
Yeah, sure. I had done camera and editing of a short film earlier that summer, directed by Lauren Spahn, who's a great new storyteller, and produced by Seth Mitchell, who is, you know, very interested in exploring new ideas, who's, you know, very aligned with kind of going outside of mainstream storytelling, knowing that new stories need to be told. And I basically just pitched to him personally this script. Again, my idea is kind of much bigger as like a corporate satire. But for a short film, it's like, okay, here's a way we can do it. One location, keep it simple. And he was able to fund the project. And we shot over 2 days. And our crew was, I think, five to seven people. The cast was very small. And that was it. It was a very streamlined operation. We shot it the Monday and Tuesday before my wedding. So thanks to my wife for allowing that to happen. So we went down to Pennsylvania, shot it, was back in time for the rehearsal dinner. Kept it small. And, you know, now it's out there. And then when it went to festivals, you know, it had an okay run, but you just see what the really big festivals want to program. And you just look at who's programming. You're like, they're not going to be interested in this.
Yeah. What was your most impactful reaction upon showing? Do you have a particular review or a particular personal interaction after someone watched your film that struck you?
I can't really. I mean, I think the thing that was most meaningful was at the a screening in Paris. Our actress, Sabrina Robinson, who played Dawn Joy, she won Best Actress for the whole festival, shorts and feature films combined. So that was really a great validation. No, I was a bit struck that some people saw the euthanasia angle and some people didn't. Hmm. So like they didn't, they kind of interpreted what was happening differently, that it was really just about improving your health, that she was there. And I know she did a lot of euphemisms. So, you know, it made me wonder, was I too subtle? Or, you know, we, in one of the edits, I inserted an extra shot of the suicide prevention hotline sticker that she eventually takes off, because I felt too many people really were thinking of it as a health program, which is interesting also to think that, like, she could say all of these pretty obvious euphemisms and people really thought it was about health and about quitting drinking and living your best life, being healthy. So I don't know. That was interesting to me in terms of, like, was I not clear enough, or is that just interesting how it affects the audience's psychology to not always see it?
That is interesting, because I guess that kind of makes me concerned. Like, if there's Canadian clothing commercials that are subtly hinting at euthanasia, and maybe somebody like, yeah, that looks like a great shirt to buy or something, you know? And the same way you watch this, it just,
I think it speaks to the euphemisms as one part of it really speaks to the whole normalization process. You know, that what are we going to do? Canada's at 5%. Like, what if 10% of all deaths are euthanasia? What if, like, 20 years from now, by the time you turn 50, people kind of start asking, you know, are you going to do 60 or 70? How long are you going to stay around?
Yeah.
You know, and it sounds absurd. And that's, again, why I think satire is the way to go with it, because there's some kind of absurdity to it. But the thing is, once it gets normalized, it's hard to question. So I think it's really important to find ways to question it now.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I mean, how many people have just lived life and things that would have been unthinkable 20 years ago are now just, not only do you have to accept it or just like let it be, you have basically have it rammed down your throat. And if you disagree with it, you have people kind of viciously attacking you for being, you know, uncharitable, I guess. And there's plenty of examples I could think of. I'm not going to name one now, but I see precisely what you're saying. And even the terminology too, like it reminds me of, depending on what side of this you're on, people, it's the pro-life movement, basically the pro-life movement. And then, well, some people say, well, it's just the anti-abortion movement. And it's like, well, we want to take that teeth out by saying that euthanasia, we're going to call it medical aid in dying. So we don't need to use that loaded term. And it's just a shift on a rhetorical battlefield for acceptance.
Yeah. And I think at this early stage of the, well, it's not as early as it could be, but it's really time to talk about it. The words that are used are really important, and talking to different, you know, call it stakeholders in the process. Nobody really thinks about what this means for the medical profession.
Oh, right. Yeah,
so when you call it medical aid in dying, you're saying when you go to the doctor, they're going to cure you. They're going to help you. They're going to care for you. They have your recovery and care in their best interest. But now you're saying they'll do that and also maybe recommend that you die. And that is happening. And I'm sure, honestly, anybody, because I've seen so many cases of this, I would bet anybody could ask people they know, especially older people, if they've been in the hospital, whether there wasn't some pressure to move quickly into hospice care or, you know, once that option's on the table, it changes the equation. You know, and then if you get shunned for kind of denying them the right to end their life in dignity and whatever kind of euphemisms they have, you know, it's better to talk about this earlier than later. But doctors are being trained now, you know, and doctors are being refused advancement if they're not going to accept medical aid in dying. That just becomes part of your curriculum. And there's a lot of nurses and doctors out there who are fighting it, and they need more support.
Wow. So one thing I keep thinking of, and maybe I'll end with this, is you keep saying, you know, dying with dignity is a word used. It's like, well, you might as well go out on top, and because, you know, watching someone suffer in public is undignified, or just wrestling with suffering in general is undignified. And the argument you're making against the argument for, quote, dying with dignity or easing pain or living your best life, whatever that may be, means that you have to wrestle with suffering. And therefore, mm-hmm. you would see some type of purpose in suffering, because otherwise, you know, what would be the issue? Like, I see a lot of suffering ahead of me. So I guess I'll just ask a very open-ended question. What value do you see in suffering for the human condition, valuable enough to combat the argument to just to end with dignity?
That's a very deep question. And I believe that suffering has value. I believe that there's a lot of things that you can accomplish in life only through suffering, and that it's, you know, you may see your reward for that in this life, or you may see it after. But running away from it isn't the answer. And it's not easy to say. You know, we live in a culture where, you know, everything's made to be convenient, everything's made to order. And most of all, it's about saying, it's my choice, you know, that we have the right to be as selfish as we want about what we do with our lives. But I think that negates our responsibilities to other people, and often, and just to existence itself, you know, that we will experience suffering, and, you know, you can't run away from it at every turn. And, but suffering is real. You know, suffering makes you want to make it go away. So it's really hard to say that, like, you know, at this level of stakes of life and death, you can just choose not to suffer. Like, I know it's a hard problem. And again, with euthanasia, suffering is not the only solution. There are also other types of palliative care. And so part of the problem is that, you know, we're going to be reducing people's options for palliative care. You know, I don't know if they'll be rationing morphine or whatever to kind of push you towards saving money or making this easier on other people. It's unfortunate. It's a very deep question. It's an unfortunate part of the human condition that we will suffer, and sometimes we have to choose suffering. But I think there's a lot of nobility and actually a lot of dignity in that. And I think a lot of people, and I know people in my life too, where you've seen a lot of dignity at the end of their life in the suffering they had, or amazing things that happened in the last 2 weeks of their life that provided so much meaning and closure, and added a level of meaning to their entire life, because special things do happen at the end. And, you know, eliminating the suffering, you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater, throwing out, you know, miraculous things that can happen at the end of life as well.
Yeah, I often think of Pope John Paul II at the end of his life, still being very public for us, basically. And because one thing that gets missed with this is it's framed as good for the person who is suffering. And because suffering is uncomfortable, but it's a reality. Everyone's going to have to suffer at some point. It's inescapable. But I think the missing thing is for the person witnessing the suffering or caring for the suffering, that is you rob someone of that frame of mind if you just enter a total cop-out answer of, well, like, you could just end it. I could help you end it. Instead of accompanying someone in that moment, how that alters your soul, how that alters your attitude towards other people around you, even your visibility to suffering. Because if you never saw anyone suffer, you wouldn't be prepared to suffer yourself, but also it changes how you think about the world, life and death. And it feels like, you know, we're undergoing this grand experiment where we're completely, probably the most secular country in the history of the world. And we're just single-handedly removing every single part that is unseemly, uncomfortable, arduous. And we're just kind of, you know, throwing our shoulders up, like, we'll see how this affects us. And I think we often can't pinpoint the manifestations of removing those natural things until too late almost. And so I think it's really beautiful what you've done with Breakfast of Champions, and hopefully like good art makes people think about the things we're thinking about, like the profound, the divine, the mysterious. suffering is really mysterious to me.
100%. And I think so many people come to, you know, profound epiphanies through suffering, much more so than through, I think, you know, joy is a great way, beauty is a great way, but suffering is like the unavoidable way. Suffering is like you are when you suffer, you're forced to think about the pain and ask yourself what caused the pain and ask yourself, I don't know, maybe questions of your own life about how you got into that situation, why we experienced this. If you take that away, I think the consequences are actually very dangerous, like you said. And I actually agree very much. Pope John Paul II, when he was gave his final Easter mass
address,
the balcony, and he couldn't even speak. And that was profoundly moving to me, that he was at the end of his life. And I remember watching that. It looked like he was trying to, and he was a week from death, and he couldn't. But that was extremely moving. And things like that have profound effects on people. And, you know, unfortunately it's a hard thing to walk through those experiences, but they have profound value in the end.
Yeah. I think much more profound than anything he could have said, you know, like just sharing that with the world in his silence, but his presence. And similarly, maybe a good reminder to always be looking around for the people suffering around us and to accompany them in their suffering. Andrew. So this, of course, go check out Breakfast of Champions. Do you have any projects coming up, working on? What is next on your radar? Do you have anything in particular you're excited about?
Yeah, right now I'm developing a documentary with Sean O'Hare, who also has a podcast on Zeal,
awesome.
And Doug Lyman, exploring the Catholic Church through the eyes of a skeptic and a believer. So that's a really exciting project. I'm writing a couple things, you know, you never know which one's going to work. They're all at different stages. So writing about a woman, again, I guess it's also against the avoidance of suffering, a woman who finds herself pregnant and gives up her baby to a doctor who promises her eternal youth in exchange for putting the baby under a spell for 40 years.
Wow. You're not going with anything light, Andrew.
it's got its funny moments. I mean, the thing is, when you take a really serious topic, you can have a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so
do you think that's kind of missing now? I almost feel like I'm so tired of the, and no offense because he's done some good things, but like Ryan Reynolds' sense of humor, like it's very much like the Marvel kind of everything's a joke, so nothing serious. So, but there's no like stakes or premise to actually change mood or attitude off of because the entire attitude is irreverent. So there's no way to get that kind of like, oh,
you,
like
you have to
punch.
Ground it. Yeah. And my, you know, I have a background in comedy and I had a show at Upper East Citizens Brigade 20 years ago. And, you know, the lesson there was always grounded in truth, you know, and the more you know about the truth of human nature and really the truth of suffering, the more you can be funny because you're being honest. You're not being flippant. If you're flippant about everything, then humor has no contrast and has no depth, you know? So, you know, I think it's just always been my sensibility a little bit on the dark comedy side, but a little bit, I think that's pretty accurate to the human experience. You know, we have dark things and we have lightness, and we have to kind of live with both of them. So I don't know, that's always, and I think that's very powerful to the audience, and ultimately you want to move them. And, you know, so much of this, like you said, this kind of Marvel light sensibility, it's just like, what is this for? It's just I think to me that stuff is just stimulating your brain in a very kind of neutral way of, I don't know. Yeah. But culturally, like, you have to get more serious people. You need more serious people involved in film production. People who want to say something, but not say something ideologically. People who want to be deep and understand the power of film and the culture. And I think we're kind of at a low point in terms of that, but hopefully that's turning around.
Which maybe you could see it as an opportunity, an opening.
Yeah, so. I like that. We just need people out there to support it. Unfortunately, film is not a cheap medium. So that's kind of where the tension comes into play, because you have an idea and they're like, yeah, but it's going to cost $2 million or $10 million. And, you know, somebody has to be willing to take a shot on that.
Yeah. Well, here's the people that take more shots. Andrew Shemin, thank you for joining the show, and go check out Breakfast Champions. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot.